You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, last year, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel started a series of investigative pieces looking at the real estate market in Milwaukee, from shady landlords to predatory rent-to-own practices. We'll check in and find out what's changed.
First, so far this year, 18 Milwaukee overdose deaths have been blamed on a fentanyl derivative. This particular derivative is so potent that it can require multiple doses of an opioid antidote to reverse an overdose.
This got us wondering what exactly fentanyl is and how it's affecting Wisconsin's communities. Sarah Schreiber is a technical forensic director for the toxicology lab in the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Well, take us through a little bit of an education course here. What is fentanyl?
It's a synthetic narcotic analgesic. So this means that it's man-made. It's a highly potent drug that's used for the treatment of pain. It's generally prescribed to individuals who have chronic pain related to cancer or a severe injury. It's got a short duration of action, which means it doesn't last long within the body. And it's been in use since the 60s, so this isn't really a new compound, in the nation and in use as a pharmaceutical product, that is.
So it's used for killing pain. How does it affect the human body?
Well, it is used to deaden the pain, so it takes away that sensation of pain. It's also a central nervous system depressant, and by that respect, it causes respiratory depression. This is where the real risk aligns for folks that are abusing the substance.
And how is it showing up in illicit drugs here in Wisconsin?
We're finding what's being coined as non-pharmaceutical fentanyl, or NPF, in preparations and in individuals. Particularly in my office, we're finding them in decedents who are dying as a fact of exposure to, I don't want to say overdose, because that perceives that there's some sort of safe level. So we've got individuals that are being exposed to these drugs, whether that be of their knowledge or not, and they're dying with that substance in them, which is causing their death.
And is it because there is so much of the drug going into them, or what is the death exact? Why is the death happening?
The ultimate mechanism really is the respiratory depression, which comes from the use of these drugs. There's many different derivatives that are identified. They're all related to fentanyl, which is a Schedule II substance, prescription medication. But the derivatives that we're finding these days are all mostly designer in type, meaning that they're not intended for medical use. They haven't been formulated in that way, and they've never been accepted for medical use either in people or in animals. There are a few exceptions to that in the derivatives that we've found. But what it essentially means is that the potency of these drugs is increasing with the different derivatives as they're identified, and the increased potency is what's causing trouble for the individuals who are using, especially if they don't know that they're receiving that drug in the mixture of the powder that they're administered.
So we're talking about changing the chemistry of the drug to make a derivative?
Correct. So they're all related to fentanyl in some way, so they're similar to, whether that be structurally, pharmacologically, both. That's where the phrase derived from comes from.
And who's making these new adaptations of fentanyl? Where is this happening? Where is this chemistry going on?
They're all synthetically prepared, so they're man-made. And information, intel into the drug trafficking is telling us that most of them are coming from China. They're being imported. The heroin product has been contaminated with this fentanyl compounds for quite some time now, as it tracks into the country, and now we're starting to see contamination into the cocaine line as well.
And here in the U.S., where do we see the trafficking of fentanyl and its derivatives?
It's imported, so it's coming in through Mexico. It could be coming through through the ports. There's also, because of the World Wide Web, the opportunity for individuals to order these substances on their own, should they really desire to do that. Oftentimes, though, we're finding it in combination with things like heroin or cocaine, which is leading us to believe that it's coming through those kind of general trafficking lines.
We're talking right now with Sarah Schreiber. She's a technical forensic director for the toxicology lab in the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office. We're learning about fentanyl and how it gets here, how it's made, and just how potent it is to the human body. We've seen a number of deaths, 18 in Milwaukee, overdose deaths blamed on a fentanyl derivative. Sarah, there have been a lot of reports of fentanyl-laced cocaine in Madison. Is fentanyl affecting drugs other than heroin in Wisconsin?
Yes. I'm not specifically aware of those cases. I'm aware of the ones in Milwaukee County as far as the death investigations that we're involved with. So I would not be surprised that they're seeing them in other places of the country. I certainly know that they're being found in other places in the nation. We have identified 22 of the fentanyl cases of the 66 that we have to date, 22 of those have also had cocaine present with the fentanyl or fentanyl analogs within the body. So the combination is definitely here. I can't at this point prove that they weren't just co-administered and that the cocaine line is definitely contaminated, because once it's in the body, it's just detected as individual compounds. And oftentimes the substance that they actually used is completely used up by the decedent prior to their death, or it's cleaned up from the scene before anything can be analyzed. So we don't always know within that powder that they may have been abusing whether or not it is a combination of cocaine and fentanyl or a fentanyl analog or something different.
And how does fentanyl change the way first responders are treating overdoses?
Well, it's necessary to use more naloxone, so that's the active ingredient in Narcan. More doses are needed in order to counteract those highly potent effects of fentanyl or these analogs that are being identified. The EMS may not realize that that's what they're coming upon when they arrive at a scene and work to resuscitate an individual, but it's certainly becoming more pronounced that more doses are needed as the potency of these compounds increases.
And in your toxicology lab, what are you looking at here as you examine these deaths?
We're looking at the biological fluids that are obtained during autopsy. So during the course of the autopsy, blood is obtained. That's the fluid that we most frequently use. We will look into other fluids if necessary or tissues. So primarily blood, and we're looking for an array of fentanyl analogs in specimens that are screened positive for fentanyl in earlier testing.
And we've been seeing lots of marketing campaigns, not marketing, but just public awareness campaigns about the issues around opioids and addiction, and now fentanyl here. What is a takeaway message about how dangerous these compounds can be, these drugs can be?
They are very dangerous. Each of the analogs has different potency. Fentanyl itself is somewhere around 80 to 100 times more potent than morphine, a well-known pharmaceutical drug. These analogs, as they increase in potency, come with increased risk, up to and including carfentanil, which is approximately 10 to 100,000 times more potent than morphine. And there are several in between there. So as the increased potency is found with these different compounds, there comes an increased risk to the user in the end of suffering from that respiratory depression that comes with these drugs.
And how are officials keeping track of fentanyl and its derivatives as they crop up around Wisconsin? Are you in contact with other toxicology labs, or how is information being shared?
Yes, I am in contact with other toxicology labs within the state and within the nation for information sharing related to these kinds of findings. I'm definitely in close contact with the individuals in the Milwaukee area and in the state of Wisconsin to keep up on trends. What's new? What are we finding? What's the newest analog that's being identified, both from a confiscated standpoint in materials that way, as well as in other death investigations or human performance analysis that might be done on individuals to see what the other substances are that are being found. The 18 that we're speaking of here are related to acrylfentanyl, which is only one of the analogs that we've actually identified. To date, we have 66 cases that have been signed out as a cause of death related to fentanyl.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us and explaining. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for your time.
That was Sarah Schreiber, Technical Forensic Director for the Toxicology Lab in the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office. She joined us to explain what fentanyl is and how it's affecting Wisconsin's communities.
First, for people looking for housing in Milwaukee, there are a lot of challenges in the market, from questionable rent-to-buy practices to negligent landlords and the risk of foreclosure.
Last year, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel released a series of articles delving into these issues, and our next guest is here to tell us what has changed over the past year.
Kerry Spivak joins us now. He's an investigative journalist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been monitoring the city's real estate market. Kerry, welcome back.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, you've been covering this issue of landlords buying these foreclosed properties. Can you remind us of where this is going wrong, some of the problems that this is creating?
Well, the key thing that we've been writing about is how the municipal court would fine landlords and they would never bother paying those fines, and they would continue going out there, not paying their property tax either, for that matter. And yet every Monday morning in Milwaukee, you'd be able to find these same landlords at the sheriff's sales buying more properties, many of which they would not put any money into, and they would become run down. They wouldn't pay their property tax, and eventually the city would end up seizing the property, and it just was a circle that went round and round. Of late, you've had the state of Wisconsin, the AG's office, took an action against a company called Vision Property Management out of South Carolina, and they've been doing the rent-to-own type business with properties. And the problem with that the state sees is that people will purchase, they become renters of a property, but they'll do a rent-to-own deal. But the buyer or the tenant is responsible for all the repairs in the property, tens of thousands of dollars, but yet if they miss one payment or two payments, they would tend to get evicted. The state is going after Vision Property, trying to crack down, or actually trying to ban them from doing the rent-to-own business in Wisconsin. That's pending in court right now.
How common is this rent-to-own arrangement?
They have nationally probably about 6,000 properties in 40 states or so, and they've been criticized in Congress for it. You don't have lots of companies doing it. It's kind of one of the newer practices that you've seen within, you know, recent probably 10, 15 years or so, but it's really been growing because you have so many people who don't have the money to purchase a home yet want to buy a home. And you'll see the signs all over the place of, you know, rent to own home, or, you know, call this number, this home cheap, that type of thing. And that's how they do a lot of their marketing.
Yeah, talk through how this works. If I'm the person who's renting to own, I go in, it looks like maybe a good deal. I'm paying this money in. As you say, I'm liable for repairing the house. What happens if I miss that payment or something? Do they keep all the money I've put in?
Oh, yeah, that's the killer. I go in there, and it's going to be a beat-up house. It's going to be a house that they bought on a foreclosure. And I go in there, and I agree, I will fix the roof. I'm going to be responsible for back taxes, which are frequently there. And we've had people say that they spend tens of thousands of dollars doing the repairs on the home, and then they just can't keep up with it, and they miss a rent payment or two, and they end up being evicted. Now, in the company's defense, they argue that many times people do keep up with the payments and they eventually purchase it, but the amount of your rental payment that's going to the purchase usually is pretty small. And in fact, in Milwaukee, it came to light a couple of months ago, because he had an individual in that case, in that situation. The property was in Vision Properties, one of their LLCs in their name. Because they had not kept up with their property taxes, nobody paid it, neither the renter nor Vision. The city seized the property. Vision no longer had title to it. The city had title. You know, they were going to do their thing and do whatever happens after they seize it, which is generally they take control of the property. But Vision, even though they didn't have title, tried to evict the tenant, which really was confusing because You cannot evict a person when you don't own the property. That has been resolved initially, but there might be some more court action coming on that.
If I'm the company in this case, it seems like the best case situation might be I rent to own this to someone for a while, make some money off of them, evict them, keep their money, keep any repairs they put on the building, and then find another customer and rent, do the same rent-to-own arrangement for the next person. Is that what's been happening?
You just did a much better summary of the Attorney General's lawsuit than I did. Yeah, that's pretty much 100% on target. Now, they're not their business now in Wisconsin is frozen because of the suit. They've agreed not to be renting any out. But the action's pending in Milwaukee County, and it's going to be up to the judge at some point to decide whether this is a legal or illegal practice.
Yeah, it's not clear technically if they're breaking the law. Is that right?
That's correct. To the best of my knowledge, no other city or state has gone after them. That Wisconsin is the first one to go after them. There's been media stories across the country, but this is the first time that there's been an action, and it's pending in Judge DeLay's courtroom in Milwaukee.
We're talking to Carrie Spivak from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about rent-to-own and other landlord problems in the Milwaukee area and beyond, it turns out. And Carrie, it seems like a common theme, whether we're talking this rent-to-own or the property owners who owe a lot of debt but still are able to go to the sheriff's auction, like you were saying, and still get properties, mm-hmm. even though they might owe a lot of money. It seems like there's a lot of gray area that people don't really have set laws and procedures for to keep these things under control. Is that right?
Yeah, it's operated pretty much out of the limelight for years. I mean, the weekly sheriff sales in Milwaukee are literally in the basement of the public safety building. And as Mayor Barrett in Milwaukee once noted, that you're using laws that are probably going back to the frontier days on how you deal with a foreclosed property. Now, Representative Goyke has said that he will be bringing in a bill with bipartisan support to try to bring the foreclosure process up to at least the 20th century, maybe even the 21st, try to do the sales online, try to get some feeling for who are the owners of the LLCs, which are frequently buying the properties, because right now an LLC, which is a limited liability company, the whole idea of an LLC is to keep your identity secret. Which could cause problems in who's buying these properties.
So if landlord Rob Ferret owes $300,000 in back fees, but Robco shows up at the auction, my LLC, that might not necessarily be traced directly to me, and I can buy stuff as a different entity.
That's true, and you know what? Even if you're there as the registered agent buying it for the LLC, it's perfectly legal. Even though everybody knows that's your LLC, there's no law to prevent the LLC, which is a separate entity, from purchasing that property. There's people who have, dozens of LLCs.
Now, you wrote about a small change. I think you wrote this last month, a change that went into effect, a state law that affected originally only Milwaukee County, as I understand it, that said when a property sold in sheriff's auction, it has to be sent to the Register of Deeds. It sounds like a small thing, but it was important. What difference has that made?
In Milwaukee, they say it's working very smoothly. You're right. It sounds like a small thing, and it is, unless you happen to be the poor guy who lost your property in a foreclosure, and this is a true story, moved out to Denver to kind of start over again. And one day you get a phone call from me saying, I'm a reporter back in Milwaukee, and did you know that you're still listed on government records as the owner of the property, and they say that you owe X number of dollars in property taxes? That was happening I wasn't calling the people on over and over again, but that situation was happening over and over again where these people thought they lost their homes, and which, they're pretty down as it is. That's pretty bad to lose your house in a foreclosure. They left the house. They figured that, that's it. I don't have title to it anymore. And technically, they did not have title, but if the deed is not filed with the register, there's no way for city government and others to realize that the person who lost the property no longer has title, so they keep sending the tax bill, water bill, et cetera, zoning violations, et cetera, to the former owner, as opposed to sending it to the new owner. That bill passed, it was put into the arena bill, that I think that was 2015, for Milwaukee County only. Recently this year, a similar bill statewide to give the county officials the ability to do the same thing, mandate that the deeds must be filed immediately as soon as the foreclosure sale is over and approved by a judge. That was approved by the Assembly and is now pending in the State Senate.
You've been writing, as I said at the outset, about these issues for a while now and reporting on problems with the sheriff's auctions and these property owners who keep showing up. Have you seen much change since you started reporting on this?
A little bit. The city has gone after one of the biggest slumlords, Mohammed Chowdhury, and all of his properties were placed into receivership. He's trying to get them back, but that's pending in court right now, and the city is running the properties. And you see from some of the initial reports how profitable of a business it could be. I believe the city said they were bringing in something like $40,000 a month in rent. They were going to go after another landlord, Elijah Muhammad Rashid. However, and same type of thing where they were going to put the properties in receivership. Rashid struck first, and he filed an action against the city, and that's pending right now, so we'll have to see how that plays out, if the city will be able to place those properties in receivership or not. There's still an awful lot of guys, though, who do not pay their taxes, do not pay their fines, and still are out there buying properties. So, yeah, there have been a little movement. I wouldn't say it was fast-tracked or anything in terms of the movement, but there does seem to be a little bit of movement in going after some of these guys.
Kerry, I'm sure we'll talk to you about these issues again. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Have a good day.
Kerry Spivak is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us for a look at shady practices in Milwaukee's real estate market and efforts to rein them in. First, an update on the latest news on the Waukesha water diversion proposal. The Great Lakes Compact voted to allow Waukesha to ask for Great Lakes water since the city is within a county that straddles the lake's basin area.
Now, Waukesha officials are analyzing a plan from the city of Milwaukee. The other offer on the table is from Oak Creek, and Waukesha should know in a few months which area will supply their Lake Michigan-sourced drinking water.
Chuck Kornbach joins us now. He's WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee. Chuck, welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Before we get into the details of the dueling deals here, remind us why Waukesha needs an alternative source of water, ultimately looking at Lake Michigan.
And that duel is being fought with water pistols, I think. The issue, again, is radium in Waukesha's water supply, a contaminant that could is a potential cancer causer. Waukesha has been on their deadline of about next year to do something about this, and this was their plan they ultimately decided on, was to get lake water from Lake Michigan.
And now this deal is approved by the Great Lakes Compact. The question, I guess, now is where does the water come from exactly? How does it get to Waukesha? What were the possible deals on the table?
Right. Well, Oak Creek, a suburb of Milwaukee County, just a little ways south of city of Milwaukee, won a sort of a three-way competition a year or two ago between the city of Milwaukee, the city of Racine as a water supplier, and Oak Creek. But the Oak Creek is 20, 25 miles from Waukesha. Waukesha is going to have to build a pipe to Oak Creek's water, inland water system about 25 blocks in from the lake, and that's more costly than it would be to get the city water from the city of Milwaukee. You know, but all along it had kind of looked like that was what's going to happen, that Oak Creek would get the deal. I did tour the Oak Creek site with some journalists from the Institute for Journalism and Natural Resources back in January, and The Oak Creek General Manager Mike Sullivan said, listen, we're not banking our future on serving Waukesha. If we don't serve Waukesha, we're doing just great. We're here to serve them, but not relying on them, I guess. So, you know, that sort of told me that, okay, Oak Creek is not going to bend over backwards for this deal, and there isn't a deal yet between Oak Creek and Waukesha.
And Milwaukee, it sounds like people, at least in headline writers, have used the word surprise to describe Milwaukee coming out with a new offer. Is it that surprising?
Well, Mayor Tom Barrett of Milwaukee, with whom I spoke today at midday, said, listen, I've said for some time now that we're available to supply water to Waukesha ever since the Great Lakes Compact Group, the group representing governors, last year reduced the footprint, the service area where Waukesha would use this water. Barrett had been concerned about fueling with water growth in Waukesha County, but now he's content, he says, that it would just serve basically what the law says for Waukesha and not contribute all that much to growth. Still, we asked him today, aren't you trying to elbow out Oak Creek with this offer?
Well, no, I don't think it's an elbowing out at all. I think for Oak Creek, for Waukesha, for Milwaukee, I think the best thing to happen is everyone looks at it and sees what's in their best interest.
So is this potentially a big moneymaker for Milwaukee or Oak Creek?
Well, it could be. Milwaukee has, for some decades, I think now, had an overcapacity in its water supply. Breweries have cut back, shut down, or been more efficient in using water. MillerCoors announced today it's using 15 billion fewer gallons of water. That's company-wide. So breweries are becoming more efficient. Milwaukee would like to sell water to more customers and has to other suburbs in the basin, but they would like to sell to Waukesha, I think, for some money. Oak Creek says, as I said, could gain money, but says, listen, we're okay if we don't sell to Waukesha.
Any idea when Waukesha is going to make a choice?
Well, the water utility general manager, Dan Dukniak, spoke with him briefly this afternoon. He said hopefully later this summer, by early fall, he'll have a recommendation. He and his water board will have a recommendation for the Waukesha Common Council.
Chuck, thanks for bringing us up to date on this long-running saga.
Thank you.
That's Chuck Krumbach, WPR reporter in Milwaukee. He joined us for an update on the latest news on the plan to divert Lake Michigan drinking water to Waukesha.
Now we're turning to another water topic. On Friday, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources released proposed rules that require stronger manure management practices in many Wisconsin counties. These rules are aimed at protecting groundwater from contamination.
Scott Lasser joins us now for more on these new proposed rules. He's a water quality specialist at Clean Wisconsin. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, and thanks for having us.
Well, what would change if these proposed rules went through as written?
Well, the draft rules basically have some new requirements for manure spreading, and they're really focused on the most vulnerable areas of the state. So there are parts of northeast Wisconsin where we have really shallow soils, and you don't have to go down very far, and you hit rock. And it turns out that that rock up there also has a lot of cracks and fissures and holes in it. And what happens is when we put things on the surface, like manure, that have pathogens and other contaminants in them, and we get rain, they can really easily get down into the groundwater and contaminate community members' wells. And some of the recent research that's been done up there has shown that contamination can happen very quickly in a matter of hours, sometimes after a rainstorm. So that vulnerable landscape is where these rules are focused. And what they will do is try to move manure application away from private wells and community wells and other areas like sinkholes, which make it really easy for surface water to get down into the ground. They'll also reduce the rate, the amount, basically, of manure that can go out at any one time, which will help reduce risk.
This applies to multiple counties, but Kewaunee County is where a lot of this story has been told with the geological features you just mentioned. I think something like a 5-to-1 ratio of cows to humans in that county as well. Can you talk about the water situation in Kewaunee County and how these rules might change things?
The water situation in Kewaunee County, as I think a lot of people have heard about, is difficult, and there are a lot of residents up there who don't have clean water right now. There was some research conducted by a couple of people from the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, and UW Oshkosh over the last couple of years that found a high rate of well contamination and not just, things like cryptosporidium, which I think a lot of people have heard about because we had a significant outbreak of that in Milwaukee a while back, and salmonella and some E. coli and pathogens that can really make people sick. And so the fact that those are appearing in people's wells is a big issue. And what these rules will hopefully do is, as I said, require farms to keep that manure farther away from people's wells and other vulnerable features, put less out at a time, and also focus on when it's going out. Because one of the things we've learned from research is that there are better times of year and there are more risky times of year to put that manure out. And in terms of putting it out, when you've got a dry spell versus right before a rain, that can also make a big difference. So what DNR is hoping to do with these rules and what we want to see done is some changes to these manure practices that are still going to let farmers farm and still put manure out, but really do things to reduce the risk and ultimately see people have cleaner water.
We're talking to Scott Lasser from Clean Wisconsin about newly proposed clean drinking water rules from the state DNR.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these proposed rules? Would you feel safer about your drinking water with these rules in place? If you're a farmer, how do you think these proposed rules will affect you? Call in now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're picking up our conversation now with Scott Lasser from Clean Wisconsin about the proposed clean drinking water rules from the Wisconsin DNR.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. These rules affect 15 Wisconsin counties, including Kewaunee County. They affect issues about, in particular, manure spreading in vulnerable areas, possible contamination to wells. Is this an issue that has affected you that you're living with now, whether it's your well you're concerned about, or if you're a farmer yourself? Do you have worries, or do you think these rules would be a good idea? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Scott, one thing that seems interesting, as I understand it, usually water quality rules, farming rules are one size fits all for the state. These rules key in on 15 counties. Is that unusual?
It's a first for this particular provision in our state laws. And so basically the rules that govern manure management across the state also have a provision that basically says if there are circumstances where meeting water quality standards are particularly challenging, then the DNR has additional authority to write different rules. And that's really what this is. So these are referred to by DNR and others as targeted performance standards, and they're meant to acknowledge that Kewaunee County has some more vulnerable areas and more vulnerable drinking water, and that we're going to need to do things differently up there if we want to give people access to clean water.
What about the 14 other counties on this list? What were the criteria used to select which these rules would apply to?
So the criteria don't go by political boundaries. They are based on a lot of science that's been done, and it's really based on the kind of rock that's underneath and the amount of soil that is on top. So there are parts of all of those counties that have some shallow soil and this particular rock underneath, but Kewaunee is particularly vulnerable. Door County is as well. And obviously parts of those other counties. And Kewaunee is unique in that there are more of those shallow soils and there is an exceptional amount of manure that's being spread in that county. And so, as I mentioned before, the rules try to address where that manure goes, but also how much of it goes out at once, because both of those are important for reducing risk.
Let's bring in our callers now. Dick is on the line in Algoma. Hi.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Say, I've been active in working on this issue for a long time in Kewaunee County, and I think these rules and the starting of the changes are a really good step. But there's more to be done, because this issue is not just about depth to bedrock and karst formations. We've had that issue for a long, long, long time. The question and the real problem is the water, the millions and millions of gallons of water that is used in these manure pits and in their lagoons, all has to be taken out and put someplace. And it is the water that carries the pathogens and viruses and pharmaceuticals and biologics and everything else used on the farm that ends up in that pit.
Dick, thanks a lot for calling and bringing that up, Scott. So not just the manure, but the water that's used in moving and storing the manure.
Dick is absolutely right. The water basically makes that manure, or allows that manure to get into our groundwater faster. And one of the topics that is frequently brought up is what we can do to remove some of that water from those manure management systems. And if you look at these rules, they treat liquid manure and solid manure differently, which acknowledges that additional risk that comes with all of the water that's being added to the manure. So one of the things that we have discussed and will probably comment on and work on in the rules is that water issue, and in doing more to acknowledge that manure that has had more water to it, or has had more water added to it, presents more risk, and requiring more stringent rules for that very dilute manure.
Dick, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Jen in Broadhead. Jen, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to voice my support for some stronger regulations. We farm, about a medium-sized farm, a diversified livestock farm, but there needs to be stronger enforcement. The DNR is severely understaffed. A lot of positions have been cut. So I totally support stronger rules, but there needs to be some better vehicles for that enforcement of stronger regulations as well.
Jen, thanks for the call. Scott, not just the rules, but more enforcement, she says.
Yep, I'm going to absolutely agree with Jen as well. And she's calling from Southwest Wisconsin, which is another vulnerable area of the state. I'm glad she brought that up. These rules at this point would not apply down there, but we have had numerous conversations with DNR and agricultural groups about that part of the state, because it is vulnerable. And several of the things that we've brought up that need to happen are more research on water quality issues in Southwest Wisconsin, a better understanding of what farmers are currently doing to manage manure and nutrients there, and more use and implementation of existing tools. Their DNR and our counties have more tools at their disposal to improve manure management practices, and they need to be used, and we need to do more work with farmers, both in talking about where and when and where not and when not to apply manure, and in helping them better understand and better use new tools and new practices to improve that manure management.
Jen, thanks for the call. Briefly, Scott, as we wrap up, what's the timeline for these proposed rules to become reality or not?
Yeah, so the timeline is important to mention. We're glad that they're finally out. They're something that we've been looking for since 2014, when Clean Wisconsin and Midwest Environmental Advocates first filed a Safe Drinking Water Act petition to spur action in Kewaunee County. The DNR will have a public hearing and comment period, most likely in September. They haven't publicly announced that yet, but people should absolutely watch out for that. We will have information on our website, cleanwisconsin.org, about it, and I would encourage anyone and everyone, both in Kewaunee and that part of the state where the rules will apply, but also in other parts of the state, to attend those hearings and to submit comments and to speak out about it.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Scott Lasser, water quality specialist at Clean Wisconsin, talking about newly proposed rules on manure runoff from the state DNR.
the number of Wisconsin newborns experiencing opioid withdrawal has quadrupled in the last decade. In the second of three stories, Kyla Calvert-Mason reports on a new pediatrics practice in La Crosse that cares for these children and their families and is seeing success.
Katrina's first prenatal appointment at Gunderson Health happened when she was already 7 months pregnant. She tried another doctor first, who asked what was wrong with her that she waited so long to seek care. What was wrong, she says, was drug addiction.
Fear and shame were like the driving factors that made it really difficult to go and even say to myself, like, this is really happening.
The clinic she found at Gunderson treats high-risk expectant mothers, particularly those battling addiction. Despite their support, Katrina, who asked to be identified only by her first name, says she was scared when she gave birth to her now one-year-old son, Leo.
I just felt like I didn't deserve to be his mom. And I loved him too much to let go.
That's where Dr. Ann Budzak's Gunder Kids Clinic came in. It started in December of 2015, a few months before Leo was born.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hi. How are you doing?
The idea grew out of her work in child abuse.
Hi, girl. How are you today?
I was seeing many, many children for child abuse evaluations, and thought that if there were a way to intervene earlier in that child's life, that we might have been able to prevent what was happening.
The practice now cares for about 50 children who experienced withdrawal after birth. Families have 17 appointments in the baby's first year of life, compared to 7 for the average infant. Nurse Caitlin Lillard-Pierce says they ask patients a lot of questions at each appointment that aren't about their child's physical health.
Have they changed housing locations? Do they have enough to eat? Do they have any difficulty getting to this appointment? We address if they have enough supplies for the baby. We also ask questions about their sobriety.
Katrina says they've helped her with things like formula and diapers, but when the staff dubbed themselves Team Leo, she says she began to think of them as family.
He gets the best care with people who are like really invested in him, in him developing and growing to be a healthy, normal child. I knew that I needed those people to help me. I just didn't know how much it would help.
The clinic includes a social worker to connect families with resources like housing or food assistance. It also houses a psychologist who works with the kids and their parents. But Zach says their approach is paying off.
We are seeing folks who are working very hard to be the best parents they can be. Many of the babies in our program have siblings that their parents are not raising because of the struggles they had prior to this child being born.
Katrina has 3 older children who don't live with her. She says the clinic has helped her see that something like providing a predictable routine can be a big part of being the mom she wants to be.
I think growing up for me, I never felt that, you know, and so that was really important for me to hear, because it was something that simple, like just having him on a routine every single day, or where he's knowing what's going to happen, that's providing stability. I mean, it's not like you have to do all these crazy things to show your kid that you love them.
Budzak says Gunderson currently foots the bill for most of the care the Gunder kids' families receive. But in the long run, she says the financial and social benefits of supporting stable families are immeasurable. Kyla Calvert-Mason, Wisconsin Public Radio.